Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is slated to address the country from the Oval Office tonight on what he calls the humanitarian and national security crisis at the southern border. He'll be followed by an address from Democrats, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. This on day 18 of the government shutdown. Joining us now from the Denver airport is freshman Congressman Joe Neguse, Democrat of Colorado. Congressman, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me, Jeremy.
So what do you want to hear from the president tonight?
What I would like is for him to not be doing a primetime address and to instead be meeting with the leadership of the Democratic caucus so that we can actually reopen the government. I don't think that doing an address is constructive, particularly given that we've already sent a package of clean House appropriation bills that have passed the Senate with bipartisan Republican support just 30 days ago. So, I'm not particularly optimistic about the address.
Do you think that he is going to do what he's been talking about, which is to declare a national emergency to fund the wall and go around Congress?
I certainly hope that that's not the case. I believe, like many folks who have opined on the matter, that that would be unconstitutional. I think Congressman Adam Schiff said it best that if President Truman couldn't nationalize the steel industry during wartime, find it hard to believe that this president could fabricate a supposed crisis or national emergency on our southern border to fund building a wall. So I believe that that action would be immediately challenged in the courts, like many other actions that this administration has taken. And I believe that that legal challenge would be ultimately successful. In addition, I think that the Congress will have a role to play in holding the administration accountable to the extent that the president abuses his constitutional authority in that fashion.
Well, and the president has said that he would prefer to make a deal with Congress. So what do you think can happen to end this impasse and get Democrats and the Trump administration on the same page about funding the government and ending this shutdown?
Well, you know, again, I think that the president is good and incredibly well at moving the goalposts. I mean, fundamentally, various bills have passed the House that have passed the Senate previously. Just 30 days ago, there were a series of appropriation bills that passed nearly unanimously. Those bills have been improved by the House and have now been sent back to the Senate. I am hopeful that cooler heads will prevail in the Senate and that the Senate Majority Leader will ultimately put those bills to a vote on the floor of the Senate. I believe if he does so, that they will pass on a bipartisan basis. You already see several Republican senators, as well as several Republican colleagues of mine in the House, publicly calling for an end to the shutdown and for a clean vote on these appropriation bills. So my sense is if we want to have a debate about comprehensive immigration reform and border security and so forth, that's a debate that we can certainly have. But what we shouldn't be doing and what the administration should not be doing is taking our federal government essentially hostage because he is angry that he's not getting what he wants.
Haven't Democrats, though, also moved the goalposts? They were willing to fund a lot more money for the wall in exchange for a path to citizenship for DACA recipients not a couple of years ago.
We're a Big Ten party. I think it's certainly the case that there have been some conversations previously by various members of the caucus around border security, and as you've articulated, but I don't think that the goalposts have moved. I mean, again, when you look at the bills that I just voted on just last Thursday, some of the first substantive bills had the opportunity to vote on, those are Republican appropriation bills, not Democratic appropriation bills. Mm-hmm. So in terms of moving the goalposts, I think this administration certainly has done far more of it. And again, I think right now, I've just spent the last few days visiting with folks in my district in Estes Park, Rocky Mountain National Park, which has been closed during the shutdown, folks who are being furloughed. It's hurting a lot of working families. I think it's time for all of us to just get back to the business of the Congress, which is ultimately working for the American people.
Well, and you're joining us, as people can hear, from the airport there in Denver. Did you have any trouble getting through TSA today? Those are government workers who, I guess many of them, are currently working without the promise of a paycheck.
You're precisely right. I did not. The workers that I encountered were, as is always the case, very, very effective and efficient workers who, are doing the best that they can. And as you said, it's quite frustrating to know that there are folks here serving the citizens of our country and doing so without pay and are trying to figure out how to make ends meet meet to the extent that they're living paycheck to paycheck. So it's long past time for us to fix this issue and reopen the government.
One more thing, Congressman. What do you want to hear from your party's leaders tonight from Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, who are going to give an address after the president?
I look forward to their address, and you know, I would say that I hope and I suspect that they will say what they have previously said during the course of this shutdown, which is asking and imploring this president to consider the impact that this shutdown is having on working families, to take yes for an answer, and to ultimately sign, encourage the Senate Majority Leader to put these appropriation bills to a vote and sign them into law so that we can get back to the work of government.
That is Congressman Joe Neguse, a Democrat of Colorado. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy.
Well, meanwhile, the Trump administration is also handling a blooming diplomatic crisis. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in the Middle East to try to reassure allies that pulling U.S. troops out of Syria will not jeopardize efforts to counter ISIS and Iran. Here's Pompeo speaking in Amman, Jordan today.
The president's decision to withdraw our folks from Syria in no way impacts our capacity to deliver on that. And you'll see in the coming days and weeks, we are redoubling not only our diplomatic but our commercial efforts put real pressure on Iran.
But as Pompeo arrived in Jordan to ease fears about a troop pullout, National Security Advisor John Bolton was leaving Turkey without a pledge from Turkey's President Erdogan that he would not target the Kurds in Syria, something Bolton said was a requirement for U.S. troop pullout. Erdogan didn't even meet with Bolton and wrote in a New York Times op-ed last night that the Kurds in Syria, U.S. allies, are terrorists. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie joins us. And Greg, what happened here? Reports are using words like snubbed and shut down to describe Erdogan's treatment of Bolton. Bolton issued a statement saying he didn't consider himself snubbed. In your opinion, was he?
I would say snubbed and then some. A really striking scene where President Erdogan, he didn't meet with Bolton, but he went into Parliament and gave a very public speech where he said Bolton had made a grave mistake and said that this idea that of demanding the Kurds be protected is not something they'd agreed on. So he really sort of basically told him to get out of town and I don't want to meet with you. So very striking scene there.
Well, meanwhile, Bolton is saying this was a requirement. Troops aren't leaving till I get this pledge. Pompeo is in the region saying troops are leaving and it's going to be okay. Mixed signals there.
Absolutely. And this has been the situation for the past three or so weeks where President Trump started this with a tweet on December 19th saying that the U.S. was effectively defeated ISIS. And all of these issues about whether or not they were defeated, but then all the issues about how the U.S. might withdraw was a complicated thing that you'd want to talk to allies and sort out. And now it's become this sort of public argument.
Yeah, kind of messy also in that Erdogan today also made references to demands about protecting the Kurds coming from Israel. Now, Bolton first made this announcement over the weekend when he was in Israel, standing with Israeli officials. So that, you know, obviously couldn't help Turkey's bruised feelings there. And when President Trump made the announcement that he was going to be pulling troops out, as you said, Greg, he said ISIS is defeated. Apparently, the only person he talked to before making that announcement was President Erdogan, who's saying the same thing. So did he get that information from Erdogan?
It seems so. They spoke on December 14th, Trump and Erdogan, and then 5 days later, Trump tweeted, surprising everyone and saying very much what Erdogan wanted to hear. It was that U.S. troops were moving out of northeast Syria, and the Turks want to move in, and they're making it very explicit, they want to go after the Kurdish fighters who had partnered with the U.S. Mm-hmm. And again, there's nobody had reached an agreement, neither the Americans, the Turks, the Kurds. So everybody is sort of scrambling to figure out what their position is, and they're doing it in this very chaotic, public way.
Yeah, because we remember Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis resigned along with the special advisor on ISIS, Brett McGurk, because of the president's statement. Look, what happens if Turkey does attack the Kurds? Will the 2,000 U.S. troops there who've been air cover and training for the Kurds fighting ISIS, they've very largely not been combat, won't they be forced to step in and defend the Kurds against the Turks, who are also U.S. allies? I mean, you hate to think this through.
Exactly, exactly. And that's exactly why you'd want to try to arrange this before people start making moves. Now, the U.S. and Turkey, although they're having a very rough time, they're still NATO allies. It's still difficult at this point to imagine they would somehow end up in a shooting match. But the Turks are very explicit. They want have bought President Trump's indication that the U.S. wants to leave. They want to move in. And the U.S. has to worry that if they leave, the Kurdish allies will get hit and get hit hard very, very quickly.
Well, and you also have Mike Pompeo trying to assuage fears. Perhaps the White House forgot that Iran is very much moved into Syria as well, and it's right there on the border with Israel. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie, thank you so much for speaking with us. We'll see how this unfolds.
Thank you, Robin.
For some of us, this music signals it's time to hang out the Do Not Disturb sign, to text your friends, "Do not call me," for the next hour. Victoria is on. Season 3 of the PBS Masterpiece series Victoria starts this Sunday, and we mean the royal we, of course, cannot wait. It features the young Queen Victoria of England, the second longest sitting British monarch, whose very name came to define a prudish era, but whose story is one of passion, first for her mentor, the Prime Minister Lord M, then for her husband Albert, her German prince and her first cousin, then for her people. But how much of it is true? Turns out, a lot. Daisy Goodwin is the creator, writer, and executive producer of Victoria. She's author of a novel titled Victoria, as well as a nonfiction book, Victoria and Albert, A Royal Love Affair. She joins us now. Daisy, welcome.
Hi there.
Oh, we have so many questions for you about the truth, but do we understand in our reading that Victoria had you at white britches? You were reading in a library at Cambridge University, reading her journals. What did you read?
I read an entry that she wrote in 1839 when she was about 20, and I was about the same age. And until that point, I'd always thought of Victoria as a grumpy old lady in black, a sort of sour puss in a bonnet, you know. And then here was this kind of diary of a kind of frisky adolescent, and a frisky teenager, and she's writing about Albert, to whom she's just got engaged, and she's obviously completely enamored of him. And she writes about how they've gone out for a ride and Albert's got very wet and he's wearing these tight white cashmere breeches, nothing under them. It was just such an extraordinary thing to read in the journal of, you know, Queen Victoria, that I was immediately kind of arrested by it.
Well, and apparently she had a very active and fun sex life with Albert. I mean, they did have 9 children. But yes. This is so surprising, again, because of the era and also because of her own upbringing. I mean, somewhere I was reading that she couldn't even walk down the stairs without someone holding her hand. She was this precious child who had to sleep in her mother's room. She was overly protected.
She was very protected, but that didn't stop her being very interested in sex and men.
Let's get right to Lord M. Lord Melbourne, who was the prime minister, who was her mentor when she was 18 to 21. This powerful relationship. We understand some in Britain were annoyed at how you characterized it as almost a crush that she had on him.
Well, almost a crush, definitely a crush. I mean, I don't know why they objected to it. I suppose because they feel that queens can't behave like ordinary teenagers. But I felt very secure having read her diaries. She writes about nothing else for about 3 years until Albert comes along. Lord M is mentioned on every single page about 20 times. And she almost caused a constitutional crisis, because when Lord M loses a vote in Parliament, she refuses to let him go.
Well, we have a scene, Jenna Coleman playing Queen Victoria, of course, and Rufus Sewell playing Lord Melbourne. And this is, again, very early on. She is going to Lord M to declare her love. He's watching the rooks, the birds in the trees, thinking about his wife. And we should say, you've driven a lot of Americans who might not have thought about Lord Melbourne to read everything there is about him. And we find out that his wife had a very public affair with the romantic poet Lord Byron. It was a scandal. So that explains kind of his melancholy. And here you hear that in this scene.
Did you know that rooks mate for life? Every year they build their nests together. You renew all those little civilities that make a marriage sparkle. I think we could learn much from them. If I had to spend more time watching the rooks, my wife would have felt more attended to.
She should never have left you. I would never do such a thing.
No.
I believe when you give your heart, it will be without hesitation. But you cannot give it to me.
Half of America was saying, I wouldn't have left you either, Rufus Sewell. I mean, Lord M. In that moment. So this is real. This is real history.
Yes. I mean, that particular moment was, I'm afraid, a figment of my imagination. But people used to call her Mrs. M. I'm not writing about something that people didn't gossip about at the time.
And then he dies. So we move on to the new series without him, but with Prince Albert. What is true about him? Because we know he comes from Germany. We know his family has a complicated background. But we find out at the end of the second season that he was the bastard child of Leopold, the man he thought was his father's brother. Let's listen. He confesses what he considers a shame to Victoria.
Leopold told me that he believes that he is my father.
Your mother and Uncle Leopold.
And he asked me not to tell anyone.
That's Tom Hughes there playing Prince Albert. What's true about his story?
Well, pretty much everything is true about his story. I mean, no one will ever really know whether Leopold was his father or not, but there is a great deal of circumstantial evidence, so it's not at all impossible. And there was a lot of gossip about it at the time. A lot of people thought that Albert was not the Duke's child.
Well, let's move on to the trip they make, the Queen and her husband, to Scotland shortly after they're engaged. They ride off together. Again, they're impulsive, they're young, they're in love. And get lost overnight. Let's listen.
Do you think we're lost? I don't remember any of this.
Oh.
And then they end up staying at some poor couple's house in the moors of Scotland. Did that really happen?
Not exactly like that, but they did get lost once. They were given tea and they weren't recognised, which they thought was hilarious. They probably didn't spend the night there, but they did have an experience like that. And I just wanted, for once, to show what it was like for them, you know, to lose the trappings of position.
We know that it is true that Queen Victoria was given an African child. She became godmother to an African princess who'd been captured at sea and enslaved and then released. Tell us more about that storyline.
Yes, she was the daughter of the Igbo tribe and she had been sold into slavery by another African chieftain. But the slave ship was picked up by something called the West Africa Squadron, which was commanded by someone called Captain Forbes. And he took this child home and adopted her. And the only reason she was allowed to go free was that she was intended to be a present for Queen Victoria. And so he took her to Queen Victoria, and Queen Victoria said, well, I don't want a slave. I can't have a slave. I would never accept a slave, but I will take her on as my ward and my goddaughter. So she sort of unofficially took care of her. Sarah tragically died just under the age of 30, but Victoria, you know, looked after her, was very worried about her welfare all that time.
Talk about Queen Victoria as ruler, as someone who fought as a teenager and a young woman in her 20s to be heard, to balance her husband's feelings about being second fiddle. That was not easy. Talk about the power that she held and how she wielded it.
Well, she had a great deal more power than our queen today, and she was very happy to use it. And I think that she, when she came to the throne, she didn't know what she could do and what she couldn't do, and she was very lucky to have Lord Melbourne there to kind of guide her and to kind of make sure that she thought twice before she did anything. And the one thing he taught her was always delay your decision, always. That, you know, the worst decision is a hasty decision. And I think that was a very good lesson for Victoria, who was fantastically impulsive. So it was good to have someone telling her that. And then later she had Albert, who had a very strong sense of public duty. And so they do clash, and sometimes she's right and sometimes he's right.
Well, not only do they clash, they have fights that yes, you know, history have noted. She threw a glass of wine at him?
Yes, she did. And so often she is right. I mean, when you look at some of her diary entries, she's got a very shrewd grasp of what the people want. And that's why I think she was such an incredibly successful queen.
That's Daisy Goodwin, creator, writer, executive producer of the PBS series Victoria, author of the novel Victoria, as well as the nonfiction book Victoria and Albert, A Royal Love Affair, as we get set to sit down and watch season 3. Daisy, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, spoiler alert, and I know some of you are saying too late, but when we look ahead to season 3, Daisy tells us we will meet Victoria's resentful sister, a Trump-like political figure, and while the real Albert died at 42, we do not lose him in season 3.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Trump administration says taxpayers will get their refunds from the IRS despite the partial government shutdown now in its 18th day, even though the rules require federal agencies like the IRS, which processes refunds, to shut down when they run out of money. Joining us now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
So last year, the IRS said it would not pay tax refunds during a government shutdown. Why the shift now?
So it's interesting. The IRS is not supposed to be paying refunds because it's not a matter of life or danger to official property. For whatever reason, the Treasury has asked the Office of Management and Budget to reinterpret this, and they have done so in a way that seems to not violate the law, but sort of reappropriate other funds that are still flowing in the federal government toward the review of people's tax returns and refunds. So they're basically, it seems like it's a political move to avoid the backlash of a long shutdown where, you know, a lot of people are not affected by this, but hundreds of thousands of millions of Americans are going to be affected if they can't get their refund. Remember, a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck, so they really do depend on early filing and early returns of their refunds.
And these refunds add up to hundreds of billions of dollars every year. Can the Trump administration really do that? Tell them just pay it out of this other money?
Well, you know, so it's one of those things that it doesn't seem to have a legal justification for reversing the past practice of not paying these refunds. I guess the question is, in a highly politicized world, who's going to push back on the administration. I don't think Democrats are going to say, don't pass the refunds. What it does do, though, is if people get their tax refunds, it certainly relieves a certain amount of pressure from a president who has said that this thing could go on for weeks, months. He said even years. Most people are not thinking that in April, which is when most people file their tax returns, we're still going to be in a shutdown. But there are lots of people who file their taxes early because they feel like they've overpaid and they want their refund soon. It would be hard for Democrats to be on the other side of that equation by saying, no, the law says you can't pay the refunds, so don't pay the refunds.
But the IRS has sent home 90% of its staff. So the Trump administration would be relying on people to come in and work without the promise of a paycheck.
Right. So I'm wondering how efficient it's going to be. In other words, the IRS gets swamped around, you know, between now and April every year. So I'm wondering what happens because they are redirecting funds that are already being paid to people or funds that are already existing in the government to get people to come back, which means, you know, not a lot of overtime and maybe not all the staff. And as you know, some people like in the TSA are calling in sick to protest what's going on. So I would think that at best you can expect a slower response from the IRS if you file for your tax refund. But the government seems to be avoiding a political minefield by saying if you file early, you'll get it.
Makes you think also of the fact that, you know, people are dealing with a brand new tax law. They probably have questions. They're probably calling the IRS and not getting any answers right now. It's going to be a mess when things open back up.
That's right, because only about 12, as you said, 90% of their staff have gone home, about 88%. So about 12% of IRS staff is still working through the shutdown. So answering taxpayers' questions, which is actually a huge thing. The IRS really goes out of its way every year to advertise that we're here to answer your questions. They're not able to do that. CNBC is reporting that the processing of returns and customer service, most of those people are the ones who've been furloughed.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thanks as always.
My pleasure.
The French prime minister said this week that officials will crack down on people who hold unsanctioned protests. And he said thousands of security forces will be deployed this weekend for what's expected to be another round of demonstrations. Here's French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe speaking through an interpreter on French TV.
We need to preserve the right to demonstrate in France, and we must sanction those who want to infringe on this right. That's why the government favors updating existing legislation, adopting a new law to punish those who do not respect the obligation to declare protests, those who take part in undeclared protests, those who arrive at protests with balaclavas.
Balaclavas are the masks some of the protesters have been wearing at the demonstrations. The protests were triggered by a fuel tax hike, but President Emmanuel Macron eventually abandoned that tax increase in response to the demonstrations. The violent scenes coming out of Paris recently make it difficult to remember the romance and beauty of the city, the culture, the wine, and of course, the food, which, try as you might, you just can't get here in the U.S.
Welcome to the French Chef. I'm Julia Child. We're going to make French croissants today. They're used in France mostly for the continental breakfast or petit déjeuner.
That was Julia Child, decades ago, teaching Americans about a French classic. But save for a few wonderful bakeries in this country, they didn't really figure out how to do it the French way. So on our recent trip to France, we stopped into a pâtisserie to learn from a master. Laurent Duchesne has been recognized as one of the best pastry chefs in France. He owns a bakery in the 13th arrondissement, and if you're looking for a perfect croissant, he might just be the guy.
Perfect croissant, it's a very crispy croissant with a lot of puff pastry, and it smells a good taste of butter inside.
And a bad croissant?
A bad croissant is very soft, like a brioche, and you can't have a very good smell of butter and is not creamy inside.
Why are there so many of those?
It's probably some of people get croissant already made, that's one point, and also because it takes a lot of time and process to make a good croissant.
Duchesne mentioned butter there. He says that is key, and one reason France has such good croissant game.
For us, we're using AOP butter, which is produced in France in the best area for the butter.
So the butter is very important.
Yes, butter is very important for the croissant because the percentage of butter is important and it gives the taste and the smoothness of the croissant.
So once you've got the perfect butter...
In fact, the dough should be made one day in advance because you should maturate overnight in a fridge to get all the flavor, from all the yeast. And that's very important first. And then afterwards, we should add the butter and give the layer. So it's very important to have the thin layer and very even to get something crispy and to get a very good puff pastry.
How do you fold it?
We fold it in three. And in fact, we're doing three times these things, which it gives what we call professionally three turns.
How long does it take to make one?
After you make the dough one day in advance, it could take about one or two hours to finish the croissant. Because the croissant needs to proof, needs to be baked.
What does that mean, to proof?
To proof, because the dough contains yeast, and it should rise at a temperature of 25 degrees, not more, otherwise butter will melt. And it should rise into humidity atmosphere to make sure it doesn't dry also.
And when you bake it, how long do you bake it for? What temperature?
We bake it for about 40 minutes at 180 degrees.
Celsius.
Celsius, of course.
And then how long can it last after that? I mean, when we walked into this pâtisserie, there are croissants that are in the case. How long can they stay there before it's been too long?
I mean, the best croissant is the croissant which has been baked only half an hour or 1 hour maximum before.
In Duchesne's bakery, there are baguettes, eclairs, tarts, and bonbons, almond croissants, which I took to go, and of course, plain croissants. That looks very good.
Yeah, that you see, the croissant should be well cooked to have a crispy on outside and very moist inside. And it's very important when you're touching the croissant, you should hear the crispy part, you know. Which is important.
You can hear that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very good thing.
And you don't put anything on top of it. No. We just see, what is the glisten there?
We just put what we call egg wash, which is a mixture of egg yolks, eggs, and milk, just to make it shiny on the top.
Now, there are a lot of different kinds in here. Over there, you see the almond croissant, which looks very different. It's sort of flatter.
Yeah, it's very flat because it has been imbibed with syrup and filled with almond cream and re-baked again.
And then what are the other kinds that you have there?
We have pain au chocolat.
Pain au chocolat.
Which is very classical in France. It's filled with chocolate bars.
Does it ever make you hungry to just be in front of these things?
Yeah, it's kind of thing. When you start a croissant, you should always finish it. Sometimes it's happened to me, I just want to try if it's well cooked. And I try it, but I need to finish it. So it's,
instead of just eating it along the way.
Just to taste it.
How many do you sell in a given day here?
We sell the whole totality variety of viennoiserie. We sell about 800.
800?
Yeah.
Wow. And is it...
Mainly with croissant. The best, yeah. The best sales is croissant, of course.
And how many does one individual person buy? Just one at a time? Or do people come in and buy 15 croissants?
No. Most of the time, they know we bake croissant maybe twice or three times a day, so they come even one or two times a day, but they want to get the croissant which has been baked only 1 or 2 hours before.
Are you able to eat one without having the crumbs fall all over you?
Yes, but you know, it makes a good croissant when you have all the the things fall down on you.
You have some pieces to taste later.
Yes.
They look so delicate. I mean, it's like a piece of art.
Yeah, it's very light. In fact, when you see croissant, you can see all the puff pastry, and that's what makes a good quality of croissant.
So on your white coat here, you've got a collar that has the bleu, blanc, and rouge, the blue, white, and red. What is that?
It's a competition, what we call the MOF, Meilleur Ouvrier de France, and it's a competition every 3 or 4 years, but it's the highest competition for working, hand working in pastry.
Meilleur means best.
Yes.
So you're the best.
I try every day.
Oh, look, another tray of croissants going out onto there. Obviously, you're selling out quickly.
Yeah, because we can't put, of course, all the croissants at the same time, so we have to make them one by one.
But it's early evening. Were people coming in here at this time of day to get these?
The best selling of croissant, it's early in the morning. So as soon as we open the shop, people wait to get the croissant.
When we visited in the early evening, there were still plenty of items in the case, but he won't be selling these croissants tomorrow.
No, we never sell croissants from tomorrow, from the day before.
Really?
Yes, we cook them every day.
They've got to be fresh.
Yes.
What's the difference? Can you tell the difference if you have one the next day that stayed overnight?
Of course, because overnight the croissant gets moisture, humidity, and is not crispy. He hasn't got the same taste of butter, fresh butter, so it's different for us, yeah.
Duchenne says he remembers an American visitor who was really taken with the croissants here.
He came every day. He spent a week in France. He came every morning, and he feels like he was in a shop of toys shop, you know.
Because we don't have those.
Yeah, I like this. I want this. I want to try this. And it makes me very funny, yeah.
You think it's funny?
Yeah, it's funny because it's like he's with big eyes looking everything, wanted to try everything. And I really like this, yeah.
As for Duchenne, when he's the one eating, he often goes for a plain croissant.
I like the plain one, yes.
And do you put anything inside of it, any jam or anything like that?
No, I just like croissant with coffee, that's all.
That's it?
That's it.
How often do you have that?
I try two or three times per week, but not more than this because I try to keep healthy.
keep the good waistline.
Exactly.
The 2019 Consumer Electronics Show kicks off today in Las Vegas. Get ready for walking cars, flying taxis, and can it be a plug-in Harley? Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is executive editor at Recode. He's on his way to CES right now at an airport. So, Peter, what is the biggest buzz out of the show so far?
Generally, we normally say the biggest buzz here is Apple, even though Apple isn't showing up. And that's kind of true already. We heard announcements from Samsung and some other device makers that Apple is going to basically allow you to watch Apple videos on their TV monitors. This seems like a not very big deal, except that Apple normally doesn't do this. So that's pretty intriguing. Apple also has a billboard making fun of the other tech companies.
Well, let's talk about Apple. It's made sure that even though it's not there, everybody's already talking about it. Talks first about the streaming service. Is this, do you suspect, a reaction to what we're hearing are falling iPhone sales? Or what do you think's happening here?
Apple for a while has known that it's going to be harder for them to sell increasingly large numbers of iPhones. So they've been making this push that says they're a services company, which means is we're going to sell you things that aren't devices. And at some point this year, they're going to launch some sort of video subscription service. Maybe it's tethered with other things. And what Apple is really saying is at one point, we thought you would get this through our Apple TV box. That's not selling very well, and if we want people to buy this service that we have yet to announce, they've got to be able to watch it on other devices that aren't Apple devices. So you'll be able to watch this on a Samsung device or a Vizio device or an LG device. It's Apple catching up to reality.
Right. And talk about that billboard. It says, what happens on your iPhone stays on your iPhone. Sounds like a dig at Facebook, Google, the tech companies who've been, you know, having trouble holding on to their user data.
Yeah, this is a line of argument that goes back many years, goes back to the previous CEO, Steve Jobs, going after his competitors for privacy issues. Apple's argument is we're not in the advertising business, so we're going to be more concerned about keeping your data private. You could quibble with that argument, but it's fundamentally true that Apple's business model is not based on advertising. I think in the past, that line of argument hasn't meant much to most people, and I think over the last year, particularly with all the Facebook stories, that may be more meaningful now.
Yeah, so privacy an issue at this convention. Look, talk about some of the things that are being unveiled. Yesterday, we saw pictures of Hyundai's concept for a walking car. It's got legs. It looks like a big insect. And it seems like some science fiction-y, like, fun thing or something. But then, you know, it was explained it could be for, you know, firefighters so that they don't have to walk through debris, this car would, or If somebody's fallen down a ravine, you know, the car can walk out.
You hear a lot of people who, like me, who go to CES complaining about how difficult it is to get around and what a pain in the butt it is and how almost all the stuff that you see announced never shows up. The more positive take is, that's the fun of it. This stuff is supposed to be conceptual in large part. It's supposed to show you what could happen. And it's in the same way that you go to the Detroit Auto Show, they don't show you next year's Ford. They show you a Ford from 10 years in the future that may or may not happen. The actual business that happens at CES is consumer electronics distributors and producers getting together to figure out what they're actually going to put in stores next fall. And then for people like me, it's a big deal because there's a secondary show here, which is at the media conference. Mm-hmm. It's got its own gravity here. Everyone comes because everyone is coming here. I'm going to end up meeting people who I could meet in New York, and I'm flying to Las Vegas to do it. I seem like a rational person, don't I?
No, with all the bells and whistles that you're involved with. But we just want to mention it was Bell Helicopter that has a chunky-looking flying taxi. Harley Davidson debuted its electric motorcycle. But just when we're staying with those transport items, are any going to be seen on the road any time this year?
No, I mean, any crazy car you see at CES, you're not going to see on the road this year. This is an idea. The idea is to show you something that could happen or bits of tech that might happen. Look, I've got a pair of Roku speakers in my basement that were announced at last year's CES. That's about as ambitious as things are going to get in terms of actually seeing stuff on a display floor show up in your house a year later. Samsung is showing off a new TV that sort of rolls itself up and puts itself away. That might show up in your house if you think that's very exciting and you've got the money to pay for it. You're loving it. Otherwise, this is great fun to look at and great fun to sort of imagine what could be.
Two quick questions.
Sure.
Roku speakers? I can't remember what they are.
They're speakers. They go next to my Roku TV. I wasn't planning on buying a Roku TV, but I bought one this fall, and they told me, hey, this will sound better if you buy speakers. We announced them in January. They're available now.
All right. There you go.
It's the future.
The 5G, the faster data network that could succeed 4G, products and services, just a couple that might be on display.
There's two important things to keep in mind when people say 5G is that it means two different things. One is faster phone service. So you're going to get it. There's a more interesting thing to me, which is using 5G. It's called fixed wireless, and this would actually beam the internet into your home. And that is a very real deal, important thing to regular people, because most people in America have the choice of one broadband provider. And if someone can beam internet into your home instead of having to put a wire into your home to get it there, that's a meaningful thing.
By the way, Roku TV is a streaming service. Okay. Peter Kafka, executive editor at Recode. On his way to CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, which kicks off formally today in Las Vegas. Peter, have fun.
Thank you. Take care.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.